March 23, 1981, California State University at Long Beach. Raymond Lindgren, interviewed by Kay Briegel.
Ray Lindgren, member of the faculty and administration, 1961-1980, retired in June 1980. Positions held were that of dean of the college, the first of the institution, 61 to 67, acting academic vice president, 66-67, resident director in Uppsala for the international programs, 67-69, professor of history, 1969-1980. The question was asked, or discussion was made just a moment ago, in terms of some of the phenomena of the campus. And when I came in 1961, the major thing I felt in respect to what went on was that the faculty were positive, aggressive in some instances, and that the administration, with the exception of Dr. McIntosh, the president of what was then Long Beach State College, were frightened of the faculty, and that there was a conflict and a wide schism between faculty and administration because of the two or three revolts that occurred, 1952, 1956, and 1958, the latter responsible for the ouster of Dr. Peterson, the first president of the college, and the coming of Dr. McIntosh. And it was only 2 years after that that I came onto the campus, so the feeling still persisted. And we still had most of the former administration holding positions in administration in 1961 when I came. So that feeling was one. The other was a commitment on the part of the faculty to achieve faculty power. And within the limitations of the time, because that was before much of what has gone on since the creation of the statewide academic senate, I was here then in the changeover of name and the changeover in terms of the conditions of power or authority of the faculty in 1961. When the Academic Senate was created on campus. These are some of the things. Obviously, the push for power persisted, including threats personally to me on the floor of the Academic Senate, to the effect that we've gotten rid of other deans, we can get rid of you easily enough. Those are some of the background conditions. My own coming to the institution was a result of a search committee and a weeding out of quite a number of candidates. I was then professor of history at Occidental College, chairman of the department of history, and had been involved in a number of community Los Angeles affairs, as well as in the college's activities, particularly those relating to faculty and to the commitment that the institution had vis-a-vis involvement of the community.
Why did you decide to come here?
That relates in part to the regime at Occidental. As chairman of the department, I sat on 7 committees, chairman of 4, and was involved both in the inner campus activity, organizational affairs, but also involved in 4 or 5 external, that is, Occidental to the community. And that was anywhere from an 8 to a 10 hour job per day, 5 days, sometimes 6 days or 7 days a week. So when the opportunity came to accept the position here, that was part of the consideration. I might as well get paid for administration since I was doing it the year around. The other was adventure, and it's simply the idea of, I'd like to try it. And so I did.
Did you know about Long Beach before? I mean, Dr. Coombs was one of the people who investigated in 1952, I think.
You're glad you raised that question, because Dr. Coombs obviously was involved with the discussion vis-a-vis this institution, and I knew that he had been involved. So I asked him for information. He did not reveal any of the first commission or committees. I'll hold it, Duncan. He did not reveal that he was chairman of the committee or commission that was in the first investigation in 1952, or that he knew a great deal of what was going on here. In other words, it was kind of a sink or swim. That's not first consideration. Second consideration is really Dr. Coombs himself. And I don't malign him in any way, because that's the way he operated. Once one had considered leaving Occidental, his view was that it was open evidence of disloyalty. And since he himself died on behalf of Occidental College, eventually, heart attacks, this was a tremendous thing for him, this loyalty thing. And since I had, in February of 1961, been asked whether I would apply or have allowed my name to be entered, that in itself was evidence of my disloyalty to the institution. In practical terms, and he did not give me information, it was a sink or swim. The second thing is that after negotiations had started, in other words, I was asked to accept the position here, he told me, well, Raymond, you already accepted the position. You were going. What he meant was I was going in February. In other words, revealing this strong feeling on his part. Consequently, to put it bluntly, he was rather hostile, and certainly not revealing of things. I only found out later from faculty who here at Cal State Long Beach, who provided me with the transcripts of the hearings. I only found out later the extent of his involvement, and also the fact that he had privileged information, which he could have, I think, without breaking that privilege, could have communicated to me. Did not. So I went ahead then in view of the thing, with the hope that after all of the ruckus and a new administration, Dr. McIntosh coming in 59 and myself then in 61, that there might be room or opportunity. I did not know, and I don't think there is, it's naivete or ignorance on my part or lack of intelligence. I did not know the extent of the chasm, the difference or conflict between administration and the faculty when I arrived on campus, and that is very difficult to find out.
I was wondering if, like, through the History Guild or something, you had some notion that there were problems.
Oh, I was warned, a member, more than one member of the faculty here, whom I knew, some rather closely, told me not to come, and then began to give some of their own views. My judgment after sifting through this oral stuff was that they had been affected and in some instances seriously damaged by the conflicts, and that therefore their evidence or testimony was much exaggerated. I found out later that not that much. My estimate was too low. In some instances, pretty well nailed the problems here at Long Beach down at that time.
I'm interested in your background as well as why you came here. So could you tell where you were born and where you went to school or things like that?
I was born in Kansas City and obviously many years ago, 1913, lived in and around a Swedish community in Kansas, the Swedish community is Lindsborg, where I attended high school and graduated. Had 2 years of college at Kansas State Teachers College at Pittsburgh, Kansas. Came to California as a part of a kind of summer affair because my brother and a couple of his former students were coming out. Their purpose to play in the Olympic band in 1932. So I came along as a passenger. My brother and I had a sister living in Los Angeles. Her husband was a member of the faculty at what was then LA Junior College, Los Angeles Junior College. So then when it came time to go back and I to return to Pittsburgh, my sister and brother-in-law said, well, why don't you stay here and go to UCLA, which I then did after a semester at City College in order to pick up some science units which were missing in my undergraduate program. And then I had the 2 years at UCLA, spent 2 years working, 2 years and a half because I graduated mid-year. And then went back in 1937 for graduate work at UCLA with the intent of getting a secondary credential and then eventually going on for the PhD. However, the state provided funds via graduate assistantship, teaching assistantship, and research assistantship. The first year a graduate assistantship and the other 2 years teaching assistant, teaching good old history, European civilization, the 4AD as it was then in those days, and due to the death of a friend via mount climbing accident, picked up the job he had had at Occidental College in 1942 and taught that year while revising the PhD thesis, and got the degree, PhD degree, in 1943. One of the unusual things at that time in terms of the work was that UCLA offered a specialization, not a degree in, but a specialization in Scandinavian history, which because of my background was a part of it. The result was that I have taught in Scandinavian history at Wisconsin and at Minnesota, and of course have pursued that as a research interest, have written in that area since that period. Part of the reason is the fact that my parents were both immigrants from Sweden. So I'm a second generation Swede, and have been interested in both the immigration history, I've taught that on one occasion, and the history of the Scandinavian countries.
What did your father do?
A little bit of everything. He was a farm boy in the immigration, but didn't want the farm. So he emigrated to Nebraska, where friends were. As soon as he picked up enough English to get along, he moved to Omaha to work in what was in Chicago, Omaha, and Kansas City, a standard, that is, the stockyards where the Swedes were. So he worked in the stockyards a while, transferred to Kansas City to work on the railroads, another typical immigrant thing. And there, because of his own background, he was a Swedish Baptist, one of the unusual varieties of non-Lutherans at that time. And my mother, who had been an immigrant some years before, actually, she went to Lindsberg with her parents in 1879 as a 10-year-old. And then, as many of the Swedish girls at that time, went to Kansas City, they did other places, too, larger places, to work in homes. So she was a house, well, sort of a housemaid, cook, housekeeper. And the two of them both wound up in the Swedish Baptist Church in Kansas City because it was the place where they could dance. And it was lots of fun. And Mother loved to dance, and of course she had been through the Lutheran conservative background through till 18 when she left to go to Kansas City. So she'd had enough of that. And Dad was always a lively character anyway. Full of jokes and all this kind of thing. So that's where they met. They then married, and he worked as a coachman, mother as a cook and sort of housekeeper for one of the younger Swifts in Kansas City. And then they set up Dad in a butcher shop in Chicago. So they moved to Chicago, and Dad then, he didn't have a business training. He had what in Sweden would be in, well, what anywhere would be an elementary grade school education. So that didn't work out, and they returned to Kansas City, and he went back to work in the railroad yards, and worked in the railroad yards until 1919, when he decided he wanted a farm, which is probably the worst time to pick to go to farming, because it was the post-First World War depression in farming. They farmed then for 5 years, 6 years, and eventually then Mother insisted that they give up the farming, and the little equipment and few things we had went, and farm implement side went to a brother, an older brother, and he continued then on until his death, well, until his retirement actually as a farmer in Kansas. So far as our family is concerned, Mother, and I say Mother because she was the one that did it, bought a place in Lindsberg where we then lived from 1926 until I lived from 1926 until 1930. I'll just Google that. Another background?
Do you have a brother and sister?
I have, there are seven of us. There were seven of us in the family. Two now surviving. The rest have died.
Did they also go to college? You said your sister was
The oldest got a master's degree at Berkeley. The next completed grade school, got married. Well, she worked for a while and got married as a fairly young woman. Never completed a degree. The brother that I mentioned before, who became the farmer, finished his grade school education. Then the next one got a master's degree at SC, taught in Long Beach for a time as a music teacher, and is well known among the older teachers in Long Beach. The next one, college. The next one, high school. But never went on. And then myself, with the only one of the family with a PhD, but there are two masters and two B, let's see, two masters and one BA, I guess.
Then, for being immigrants, your parents did pretty well as far as...
Yeah, despite all the struggles, they came, or their period was the period of some homesteading in the Western Plains region. But they did not join that. They remained part of the urban immigrant group, as if they had come in, say, the late 80s or 90s to America from Sweden, where the majority, not all, but the majority of Swedes wound up, that is, in eastern seaboard urban areas, workers and various industries. Lumber, one of the major ones, but that was the northwest then at that time. But they were already in the urban center, so they stayed there.
Okay. You graduated from UCLA after you started teaching after
that? Well, I got my PhD.
Yeah.
Actually speak of graduation is a little, because you can go on for 7 years in the program. I had started in 37, so that my 7 years was up, or would have been up in 44.
And what was your dissertation topic?
This was on a very obscure, really unknown Danish diplomat who was minister envoy to Russia at the time of Peter the Great, and what in general in Scandinavian historiography is called the Great Northern War, Charles the XII and the attack upon the Swedish Empire. And this was the Danish-Russian part of that attack and the negotiation between them. The individual was not himself Danish, he was German, he was Saxon, in the service of the king, well, what was the king of Poland, who was the Duke of Grand Duke of Saxony as well. And he left that service to join the Danish and remained in Russia from 1714 until his death in 1733. And I studied only the period from 1714 to 1718. And that was my thesis, title of which was Hans Jörg von Westphal and Northern Diplomacy, 1714-1718.
So, accidentally, you must have taught Western Civ, I think, for that, sorry.
Yes, they had a, rather than the Western Civ, they had a general course for freshmen, which was entitled British American Civ, which was a particular favorite of Dr. Cleland, who's a famous California historian and also dean of the faculty and vice president of Occidental at the time. So he lectured in the course. colleague then was managed the course, and that was Dr. Glenn Dumpke. And we, during the period 42-45, were the history department, with the addition of Dr. Clellan and the lecturing he did, because he handled also, and I don't know how he did it, but he lectured also, or handled also, the California history course during the period he was active at Occidental. My own program was typical of a small institution, and remember, it's a two-member department. What Dr. Dumpke and I did is to take the catalog and the courses being offered and simply divided them up. So I taught ancient history, medieval history, all two courses in European history, the westward movement, and the survey course in American history. Not all at the same time, but four classes a semester. And then during the period of the war, we went into, and it saved Occidental. If it hadn't been for that, I wouldn't have continued there, because they would have gone broke. But they had the V-12 program, which is the Marines and the Navy. They're in a program in which these individuals were given minimum 2 years of college education and then became officers. So it was kind of an officer candidate school for the Marines and Navy. So I taught Navy, Dr. Gumpke taught the Naval History one, and I taught the survey course in American history, one semester survey course in American history for the Navy people, because the Navy insisted that that be included. And obviously the students rejecting it, because they hated it. But then we concocted some other things, and had, despite the limitations and the outside teaching that both Dr. Dumpke and I were doing to make ends meet, we had a very good time.
Did you continue at Occidental until 1945.
And then the person whose place I had taken, also well known at that time in local history, he later became president of the Pacific Coast branch of the American Historical Association, Dr. Osgood Hardy, had gone into the State Department service. He had been in it before. So he, during the war period, his war service was to be consul in Panama, and then in Santo Domingo?
Yeah.
Trujillo, the dictator, was the Dominican Republic. Then he was consul and second secretary of the legation in Trujillo. Then he decided that the war was about to end, so he was coming home. Besides, he didn't like the Dominican Republic or anything about it. So with his announcement that he would be returning, and he was kind and generous in letting the institution and me know, in the fall of 1944, so then 44-45 I was hunting for a job. Not too easy then, because nobody knew what was going to happen in the post-war period. But I accepted, there were other offers, but accepted the offer from Vanderbilt University. And so in 45, went to Vanderbilt to be the European historian there. It also was a small department, 8-member, 9-member department. Stayed there until 49, then went from, on a leave of absence, went to Minnesota to teach 1949-50, then went from Minnesota on a second year's leave to Norway as a Fulbright scholar, then returned to Vanderbilt for a year as obligated, and then after some discussion of promotion and salary increases, it was all an individual bargaining basis. And that both failed, and I had an offer from Wisconsin to teach in the Scandinavian Area Studies, and with a considerable bump in salary, so we went to Wisconsin for 2 years. Then I returned in 1954 at Occidental, and was at Occidental the second time in 54 to 61 when I came to Long Beach.
Aside from the problems with faculty, What
other things did you find when you came? What did you think about the academic program? The academic program had features with which I was totally unfamiliar. I mean, industrial arts, industrial technology in particular, but also a nursing program which had just begun, the engineering program which had been established by having the retired dean of the School of Engineering from USC, Robert Vivian, set the wheels in motion, and they had a small, what was then a division of engineering, about 12, 14 faculty at the time in 1961. That was unfamiliar. And then a extensive education program going, which I think by 1981 is so badly battered by economy and programs of various types mandated from the legislature to be a bare shadow of what it was in 1961. Most of those people were rather suspicious of a historian from a liberal arts small college. They assumed that my views would be pretty well locked into the liberal arts program. And in fact, this is perhaps part of the reason why I was asked to come and given the job, that I would represent the liberal arts aspect. Eventually, within the first year, I'm quite sure that most of the people recognized that fair shake was going to be given all the way around. That what I was interested in was the maintenance of the program, its improvement, and the expansion of the program, because the 60s were the period of expansion, and the institution had developed prodigiously, even in the 50s. So that policy then was to expand, to develop a broad-based curriculum, and to maintain at least some respect for the guidelines of the master plan, which meant that we were to provide liberal arts, teacher education, and vocational education or pre-professional education. Now that's a rather broad spectrum and quite a hunk. Knowing that, I mean, my own commitment, as I've indicated, is to academic quality, to the maintenance of the program, and actually to expansion. Particularly if it could be done without damaging the program that already existed. As I said, some were very, very hesitant. One of them, a person who had resigned before I came, so there was no connection, expressed his regret later that he had resigned and gone to another state college because he saw what happened here, and he figured that it would have been a splendid opportunity to have continued what he started. It's kind of interesting because we've maintained, though it was a very brief summer contact, we've maintained contact over the years since then. The then head of the Division of Education was first hostile, suspicious, then friendly, and then when we got into conflict over interpretation of the Ryan Act, in terms of education. Again, he became hostile because I was interpreting him not in a negative fashion, but interpreting it as the intent of the Ryanair, as hopefully to broaden the education of teachers and maintain a a basic academic curriculum for the teachers so that they would be more competent in these areas, rather than the extent of professional education. Before the Ryan Act, elementary education people were not required to take anything more than the general education. In other words, 124 units, of which 40 units, because they could wrangle, they could take elementary education math to qualify for the science part, for example, or the science that was required was interpreted then as fulfilling the general education. That's an entirely different question, because that was still going on when I arrived in 1961. Well, there's where my interpretation was that the elementary education dominance or control of the program of elementary teachers was to cease, which is really the mandate of the Ryan program. And that further, the liberal arts content of the general education program was to be maintained. And since I sat with the curriculum committee, which was then, today it's called, I think, Educational Policies Committee or something, PEP Council or something of this sort. It was, in other words, a college-wide curriculum committee. Within that committee, my effort was to maintain the broad academic background of teachers and to convince the education people to come up with the best program they possibly could under these conditions, but that they could no longer have a major in elementary education. And that's where I and Dr. Seaman, who was then the chairman of the division, got into wrangles together with the then chairman of the department, who is still here, that is Dr. Perry. We had many, many conferences, hours of conferences with them and their colleagues, and the interpretation development of the program, which eventually became, for a time, the program. The thing I did not expect was the continued manipulation via the legislature of the whole Ryan Act and its interpretations by the legislature, which had been both watering down, diminishing the liberal arts content of the teacher education program, as well as increasing or developing a much more extensive professionalization, professional courses of education within the program. But that I don't think anybody could expect. The Ryan Act was supposed to be it, and that was the point.
When you arrived here, were there academic departments, or were there just...
They were in the process, agreement had been reached, they were in the process of formation, agreement had been reached that they would be, but had not yet. And one of the things I worked with was to set up, or to help set up, rather, because I did not do it myself, policies relevant to departmentalization. So with committees and the Academic Senate, which was in being then in 1961-62, set up conditions for departmentalization and then procuring their recognition on campus. And then also we had to get Chancellor's Office approval of departmentalization in a block. In other words, what we were doing was preparing for a submission of a plan of organization to the Chancellor's office for approval, which would include then the individual departments. So that was coming up. Then also, before I finished as dean of the college, we were then embarked via the reorganization. We were embarked on the development of schools and had set up the program, which eventually was adopted at that time, with five schools. That is now expanded. I've forgotten the last count, but I think it's about eight schools now. But we were mandated or required by the Chancellor's Office to maintain limitations on the number of schools. The theory behind that, or the idea behind it, being that the more schools, the more costly. And since we had 12 divisions on campus in the old days, there was reason for it. There were 12 divisions, and we were supposed to have five and possibly six, depending on whether we wanted to develop a graduate program as a separate school, which was not done originally. So that was in the plan, I think, was sort of ignored or overlooked in the implementation of the plan. That's one of the areas, the curriculum area, and the departmentalization school or college organization plan, which included, incidentally, the transfer from Long Beach State College to California State University, Long Beach, which had to be submitted and discussed and all of it aired. As to the advantages and disadvantages, this institution, unlike some of our friends within the system, was 98% in favor of changing the name. The community was opposed, but they didn't like it. They wanted the Long Beach State College. And I know. They don't refer to it as Cal State. They refer to it as Long Beach State, which is what they want. And they objected. As a part of my committee duties as dean of the college, Dr. McIntosh and myself sat as members of the advisory committee, which was composed of members of the community. And one of them, probably more than any other, Bill Grant, William Grant, assemblyman, councilman, realtor, and a little bit of everything in Long Beach. Bill Grant and his colleagues, Grant was a very diplomatic and tactful person, which you would expect from a politician. He let others lead, in particular then chairman of the advisory committee, but they voted unanimously against the change of name, or voted unanimously to retain the Long Beach State College, which with a sort of smile Dr. McIntosh accepted, and he says, gentlemen, I would accept, I will urge consideration of this resolution, but he said, you know very well that it's not going to be accepted. He warned them with that. But they were somewhat heated on the proposition. That advisory committee was a very useful vehicle for development of various kinds of community contacts. The Long Beach Foundation, for example, owes much to that advisory committee and the people on it, because they became, two of them at least, became leaders in the foundation later. Bixby. Yeah. For one, and then while I was talking before, I was trying to remember George Tomlin, very active on the advisory committee, and pushing in terms of the development of the foundation. But there are others as well. Herzog, long time, well, he was a member of, so long as my period was there, he was a Francis Herzog. Francis Herzog was a member of the advisory committee all that period. Bixby, most of the time.
Were they actively raising money, or what were they?
Bixby was active in helping with getting money from the community. But mostly, for them, mostly it was pushing the idea and allowing their names to be used for solicitation of funds for the foundation from the community.
For things like peach trees and sculptures and sculptures.
Well, that was Dr. McIntosh's idea, despite all of the peach trees, despite all of the contrary information.
Popularly, it said that Malcolm Epley was responsible.
No. It was McIntosh's idea to beautify, which was immediately picked up by the campus architect.